So this morning I'm going to talk about, plenty of space. Take your choice. This morning I'm going to talk about some of the more recent psychological research and Zen practice. And I'm not talking about brain stuff, you guys. So this is research into motivation, into personality, into happiness, that kind of thing. Okay? And I've talked about this before, but I look back in my notes and I've not talked about it since 2008. So I updated myself as a good psychologist is supposed to, and I'm trying to, and I'm giving the latest stuff. Supposedly. Okay, so I want to talk about three different concepts. The first is the concept of flow. So flow, and this is stuff that's all come out since about 1990. Although, you know, it's been around for thousands of years, which is why it comes out of Zen, which will be my point. But nevertheless, flow is a mental state of operation in which a person is so fully engaged in their activity that they're energized, they're immersed, they're focused, they're fully involved. And it was first proposed, the concept was first proposed by a guy named Mihail Csikszentmihalyi, who was working in Italy, a psychologist working in Italy. And he started working with it in the 1980s. And one of the first things he did was notice the colloquial expressions that we have. On the ball, in the moment, where does that come from? Fully present, where does that come from? In the zone, where does that come from, really? Wired in the groove. And he then started researching artists, and he became fascinated by historical Italian artists and contemporary artists. And he studied Michelangelo and talked about how Michelangelo, when he was... Here's what he wrote about Michelangelo. Michelangelo seems to have painted the ceiling of the Vatican Sistine Chapel while in a flow state. Painted for days at a time, and he was so absorbed in his work that he did not stop for food or sleep until he reached the point of passing out. Well, I don't recommend that, you guys. That's not part of my Zen teaching. But anyway, he would wake up refreshed and start to paint again, re-entered a state of complete absorption. So he studied other artists who would essentially get lost in their work completely enter their activity, and when which food and water and even sleep became secondary. So in the flow state, there's complete engrossment in whatever we're doing, without making a conscious decision to be totally engaged. And there's a loss of awareness of peripheral activities, because all of the attention is focused on this, and there's no attention left over for anything else, because we only can do so much, right? And a key component of flow, according to Csikszentmihalyi, is that you can't force yourself to enter it. It can't be. There's no forced entrance. It just happens, and it can happen while engaging in any activity. It doesn't matter. But it's most likely happens when you're performing a task or activity for intrinsic purposes. This is total Zen, you guys. For intrinsic purposes. That is, the activity itself, rather than the reward, rather than the expectation, rather than the outcome. Um, Csikszentmihalyi and his colleagues performed studies with musicians and artists. In one study with professional classic pianists who played piano pieces several times to induce a flow state, a significant relationship was found between the flow state of the pianist and the pianist's heart rate, blood pressure, and major facial muscles. I wonder how they did that. As the pianist entered the flow state, heart rate and blood pressure decreased, and the major facial muscles relaxed. This study further emphasized that flow is a state of effortless attention. In spite of the effortless attention and overall relaxation of the body, the performance of the pianist during the flow state improved. Then we have all of the sports psychology for the last 15 years on being in the zone. All of the teachers and the coaches who coach ours aspiring athletes to be in the zone. Very, very similar data, very, very similar language. Definitely flow. Then we have gaming. Video games, iPhone games, internet games. And I would conjecture that flow is one of the fundamental reasons that people play video and iPhone games. Because the goal of those games is to create entertainment, again, through intrinsic motivation. Now, I see people play these games who get pissed and quit because they're not having their outcomes. But the people who really stay absorbed don't do that. Don't do that because they're, you know, right on the app, right doing the app, whatever it is. So these games are then designed to foster an enjoyable experience, right? Which increases our motivation and draws players to continue playing. So the game designers are not dumb. They've seen the research on flow, right? They've seen it. They've studied it. They're integrating flow principles into game design. And then they have their little apps. So my wife sometimes has insomnia, not too much. And she used to get up to read. But she doesn't get up and read anymore. What do you think she does? Guess, anyone? Huh? She plays a game on her iPhone on one of her apps. And she said, well, I said, well, why don't you read anymore, Linda? She said, oh, this is so much more relaxing. She said, I don't think. I don't have to be in before and after. She said, it's almost as good as sleep. I said, oh, come on. It doesn't look as good. I don't do it. But anyway, there you go. There you go. In the middle of the night, there she is. Good developers of computer software. Talk about what? Getting into the hack mode as they're developing their software. Which means an undistracted flow state. Stock market operators often use the term in the pipe. Describe the psychological state of flow when trading through high volume days and market corrections. Poker players, you know, there's that poker channel on TV. No? Poker players use the term playing the A game when referring to state of highest concentration and strategic awareness. So in flow, generally there's a merging of action and awareness. The tennis player focuses on only the ball and there's a fusion of the action and the awareness, and a disregarding of everything else. Yelling from an audience doesn't faze someone in flow. Catcalls doesn't faze someone in flow. There's a loss of self-consciousness, And here's a guy who was playing one of his apps. I don't know what app it was. He said, "I feel like there is no me. I feel there has been a merging of me and the iPhone." Hey, what a deal. Why do you guys even come here to sit? No need to come here and sit, right? And there's a sense of time distortion. Sense of time distortion. So Csikszentmihalyi says that to maintain the flow state, we must seek increasingly greater challenges. Attempting these new difficult challenges stretches our skills. We emerge from each flow experience with personal growth and great feelings of competency and efficacy. And then he footnotes everything he does by referring to what? Eastern spirituality. That's what he footnotes. He says all this came out of Eastern spirituality. It's based in Eastern spirituality. And Americans don't think they're into Eastern spirituality, but they're into it more than they realize. Maybe in a superficial way, but they're into it. Just the terms themselves. Just the terms themselves. So Eastern spirituality, so Buddhism, so the action of inaction in Zen, and Taoism, the doing without doing in Zen and Taoism, right? Being at one with, being at one with. And we have all of the Japanese arts and athletic arts, like judo, kendo, swords, kendo, ikebana, flower arrangement. A Japanese flower arrangement, if you work on it until there's no separation between you and the activity. Aikido, which was taught, really taught a lot in the Zen monasteries, as was shakuhachi. And what we heard some flowing shakuhachi music this morning, thanks to Leo Hansen. In Aikido, the way you defeat your opponent is you soak into your opponent. You completely relinquish everything and go with the opponent. Only when you go with the opponent 100% do you defeat the opponent, and by that point you're not interested in defeating the opponent. As long as there's interest in defeating the opponent, the Aikido dance does not blossom. And of course, in the meditation we do, and the meditation that's been done in Buddhist centers for a couple thousand years, we do concentration. We have lots of concentration on our breathing, on counting, on our posture. Some Buddhists do mantra concentration or visualizations. We don't do that stuff here. We don't emphasize it. But it's all access concentration. Access concentration, which is access to what? To flow. The flow. Although we take it a little step farther, because for us, access concentration leads us into samadhi. That's total flow. And then from samadhi, we have an insight. We have some wisdom. We have some letting go of separate self entirely. And that's called jiriki in Japanese. That's the self power of meditation. All kinds of different sorts of Buddhist meditation. The same thing, self power. One pointedness. So we get access to something beyond our dualistic sense. And then we also have in Buddhism tariki. I've talked about this before quite a bit, but a lot of you guys have not heard me talk about it. That's other power. Most mystical traditions focus on accessing flow through other power, not self-power. Through chanting, through prostration, through giving yourself to God or Buddha or Jesus or the Mahatma. So that's the devotional. All the mystical traditions focus on one point of devotion, completely giving yourself away. If that ain't flow, what is? What is? So there's a lot of always back and forth in Buddhism about Tariki and Jiriki, other power and self power. But it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. We're accessing flow so that we can go beyond even trying to get into flow and just be present in the world, just be intimate with all life, which is something Csikszentmihalyi doesn't talk about, because I don't know if you could accomplish that by playing an app on your iPhone. I really don't. Although, who knows? What do I know? I didn't know how to do this one, which is Zen. So what are the conditions which promote flow? Listen to these. Curiosity. Curiosity is very important in Zen practice, you guys. If you're not curious about what the self is and what all this confusion is and all these plans are and all these concerns are, if you're not really curious, if you're not really want to look into that, you won't stick with meditation. So curiosity, very important. Persistence. Persistence, very important. Low self-centeredness, very important. Performing activities for intrinsic reasons only. So, he says he's talking about flow, and he is, but he's also talking about sin. So that's the first guy. The second one is Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell is not a psychologist. He's the only one of the three, but he's done a lot of research. He's a very good writer. And Malcolm Gladwell is the author of the 10,000-hour rule. How many of you remember me talking about this? Oh, yeah. Well, maybe it was more recent than 3 years ago. Well, the 10,000-hour rule. So the 10,000-hour rule is very simple, that these great people that we see in the world who are geniuses and brilliant and world changers aren't geniuses, don't have IQs of 232. What? They practice for 10,000 hours. That's all. And the research that Gladwell did, he did a lot of research, but he's not a psychologist, so his stuff is a little bit more shaky from the point of view of real psychology, whatever that is, right? So he did his research on what? Well, he did it on real people. He looked at Bill Gates. He discovered that what was unique about Bill Gates? Well, what was unique about Bill Gates? Bill Gates was unique, isn't that he was 13, when he was 13 years old, he had access to a huge computer. Remember when they were huge? And his mom got him in a computer group at 13. And then when he was in high school, he lived close to the University of Washington. And in high school, the University of Washington, at midnight, they opened the computer room so anybody could come in and use it from midnight to 8. What did he do? He snuck out of the house every night when it was senior year in high school. And he was from midnight to 8. Or maybe his mom even let him do it. I don't know. He was in the computer room at the University of Washington. So he put his 10,000 hours in before he was 20, or by the time he was 20. So by the time he was at Harvard, he'd already... what did he need Harvard for? I mean, really? Of course, he didn't need Harvard. And the Beatles, the same thing. The Beatles played their music in Frankfurt. They got these gigs every weekend to go from Liverpool to Frankfurt, and they played for the whole weekend to a bunch of drunk people. And so they had to play their hearts. They had to play their hearts out over and over and over again. By the time they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, for any of you who are old enough to remember that, they had done their 10,000 hours. So. There you go. And so this work of Malcolm Gladwell's correlates with work that's been done in education on overlearning, the importance of overlearning. That if you really want to get something in you, you do it again and again and again, and then it, and then it, it's in you. And then it's in you. I just read an article yesterday about summer vacation in the United States and how if we didn't have summer vacation, how easy it would be for kids to really integrate their learning, because they lose it during the summer. They haven't, they're not doing the overlearning in the summer. So Katagiri, the head teacher here until he died in the early 1990s, and my friend, I met him when he was 33 in San Francisco. He had come from Japan maybe a year before I'd met him. He was 33. He already put his 10,000 hours of meditation in. I just figured it out for this talk. I just called on my computer app and did it. I'm teasing you guys. But I'm sure he had put in his 10,000 hours. Duh. He spent 2 years in a Zen monastery. Well, 2 years in a Zen monastery, the whole day is meditation. No, it's not just this meditation, right? It's not just sitting. It's walking meditation. It's eating meditation. It's work meditation. But it's all, everything. Shikan, shikan, shikan. That's what we say. Shikan, shikan, shikan. Just this, just this, just this. So he spent 2 years in a monastery, and he'd done meditation morning and evening for another 10, 15 years. So he was way over the 10,000, and he was only 33. Dharma talks. When I first started giving Dharma talks, people said, oh, your talks are really good. They started to say that when I was young. So I got a big ego young that I had to deal with. But, oh, your talks are really good, Tim. You seem so spontaneous. No. No. Overlearning. Overlearning. Not, yes, spontaneous, because when you overlearn, you are spontaneous. You're just present. They said, oh, you don't prepare, Tim. No. I prepared 83 hours for my first three talks. 83 hours per talk. That's why I was able to be just present in the flow, right? Okay, so those are the first two guys. The third one is a woman. Her name is Carol Dweck. She's a professor of psychology at Stanford University, my alma mater. And her thing, and she talks nothing about Buddhism or Zen, but how can she not? She's not a dummy. I don't know if she chooses not to talk about it, or she's just been so focused on academia. She never mentioned it. Never mentions it. And also, never mentions it. But anyway, what is her thing? Her thing is fixed mindset versus gross mindset, right? So what's the key component of Zen thought, of Zen practice? The key component is to notice how we get stuck on our labeling, to notice how our labels box us in, how they make us anxious, how they make us fearful, how they remove options until we become so small and so needy, because we're just boxed in by our ideas, by our labels. And we become really rigid as we get older. Older people are more rigid. Young people are not rigid. They haven't all got boxed in yet. Some people get old young because they get boxed in early, but most old people are totally boxed in. And we feel some sort of pity for them, which is too bad. We don't want to pity old people. We'd like to appreciate their wisdom. But we think, oh, God, they're nothing but in their mind, in their labels. And they have fixed views about everything. So Carol Dweck did a lot of research and a lot of studying of many different groups of people. And She was also focusing on success and happiness. The most and looking at people's success and their happiness and their gratification and also their accomplishments. And she found that the people with the fixed mindsets were the lowest on all of those. And the people with growth mindsets were the highest. So if you think of yourself as a lousy dancer, or you think of yourself as a great dancer, you're probably not going to be a great dancer. Lousy athlete, great athlete, dumb, smart, that's it. Those are fixed mindsets, fixed label. And she's done lots of studies, but of course she's most famously known for her study, which is not done scientifically, of the life of Michael Jordan. I've talked about this before, but it's been 3 or 4 years. So what Michael Jordan did not think of himself as a good athlete. He did not think of himself as a good athlete. And he wasn't even a very good athlete when he was high school. He just did what? He totally engaged, and he totally loved it, and he shot hoops day after day, morning, evening, and night. He totally engaged, he totally loved it, he didn't pay attention to before or after, and he shot hoops. And in high school, he was a pretty good basketball player, but not great. By his senior year in college, he was a pretty great basketball player. But even then, when he graduated from college, he was a late draft choice. He was selected really late, and he attributed this in the research by Dweck to his grandma. His grandma said, never told him he was good or bad in anything. She never told him that. She said, "Oh, you so love this, you so enjoy this. Oh, look at the effort you made." Even when he'd racked up 40 points in a game, she never told him he was good. She said, "Look at your effort. Wasn't that wonderful? I'm so proud of you." So, of course, Carol Dweck is trying to use this in teaching kids at Stanford. And she's got all these pilot projects going, teaching kids at Stanford. So, when I talked about this at Zen Center before, and I don't remember when it was, I think it was about 3 years ago, my daughter was in town, and my grandkids were in town. My grandson was in town. He's 2. My daughter, I don't say how old. Oh, yeah, I will. My daughter just turned 40. So I was talking to my daughter about the literature, and as often she just grabbed the book and started reading it. And then she said, "Oh, this is cool stuff, Dad. I'm going to do this with Ethan." So ever since, so about a year ago, I was visiting with her, and Ethan, my grandson, made this great drawing. It was just really cool. It was abstract, and it had lots of different color and had complexity. And I said to him, "That's a wonderful drawing. You're a great artist." And Erin came in and she said, "Dad, what did you say?" And I said, "That's a great drawing. She said, "No, Dad. Look at his effort. Look at how much he enjoyed it. Talk him about that." But it is a great drawing. She said, "Yes, but remember what Carol Dweck said?" Pretty cool, huh? Pretty cool. Who is the Zen teacher? So, encourage ourselves for engaging wholeheartedly in the effort. That's what Zen is about. Wholehearted effort in just this. Whatever it is, just give yourself to it. There ain't anything else. That's all of Zen. Encourage yourself. Encourage yourself. Then flow will be pretty natural for you. And then you won't even have to be thinking about flow. You'll just be in the world. Just be close to things, but not caught by them. Is that possible, just to be really close to something, but not be caught by it at all? Is that possible? Yes, yes. So Dr. Dweck's latest work, which is in she's talking about in the Stanford magazine, which I get at home. I just pulled this out. She's working now on kids' moral development. And she says, oh, this is an article about her most recent work, yes. Young children may not have always have beliefs about ability, but they do have ideas about goodness. So now she switched to this area. Many kids believe they're invariably good or bad. Good or bad. And, of course, for a long time we thought, you know, the humanistic psychology in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s was tell them they're good, tell them they're good. Tell them they're good. We were trying to compensate for that, those decades of sort of shaming Christianity. Many kids believe they're inward, invariably good or bad. Other kids think they can get better at being good. Dweck has already found that preschoolers with the growth mindset feel okay about themselves after they've messed up and are less judgmental of others. They're also more likely than kids with a fixed view of goodness to try to set things right and to learn from their mistakes. They understand that spilling juice or throwing toys, for example, doesn't damn a kid as bad so long as the kid cleans up and resolves to do better next time. Well, that's a no-brainer. But putting these into effect is not a no-brainer, sort of behaviorally. So those are the three that I want to talk about today. Flow, 10,000-hour rule, and flexible mindset. And they're all aspects of our Zen practice, of our Zen life. And I think the only sort of ways that we can be impeded, and we can be impeded, we're likely to be impeded, we can get overwhelmed by anxiety. And that will impede us big time. Or depression, that will impede us. And then we probably need some therapeutic help. That's cool. Get some therapeutic help at any point in the process. Either through a therapist or if you need medication, through medication. Second way we can be impeded is to strain to get into flow. to strain to do the 10,000 hours so I can be like Tim. Or whoever, Katagiri. Right, get my 10,000 hours in. I'm already 42. Oh, God, how can I do that? Jeez, I'll never make it, et cetera, et cetera. How can I be more flexible in my mindset? I wasn't then. We get anxious about being more flexible. What happens? So straining to be more flexible and obsessively focus on more zazen or better zazen or trying to get it right this time and not piss so-and-so off. If we come back to the intrinsic, though, the intrinsic value of each activity, each movement, each feeling, then we're not likely to get caught by that. And even in the anxiety, we're not likely to preserve it and amplify it. And then thirdly, the third problem, it's not a problem, is that we can have an experience if we do Zen practice. If you do your 10,000 hours and you do it the way I'm talking about in here, you will probably have an experience of some time beyond flow. You will. And we call that enlightenment, don't we? We call that enlightenment. We call that huge opening. We call that intimate with all life. All life. All death. You'll have that experience. But the impediment is that you get attached to it. And then your mindset becomes rigid. Wow. Really rigid. Now, many of you may not have to worry about that yet. But if you do your full 10,000 hours and you hang out with me, you'll have to worry about it, but don't worry about it. Okay, that's what I want to talk about this morning. So, questions, comments? Yeah.
The first researcher you were talking about was
talking
with Michelangelo and all that. thing, how it comes out of Eastern tradition. I don't think it comes out of Eastern tradition. I think it comes out of the human condition.
Good.
And that the Eastern traditions have found a way to describe or codify.
Much better. Thank you. Much better. Yeah.
Thank you for your effort.
Okay. What else? Who else? Yeah.
Something that about the first one also, something that kind of I'm curious about is that it seems like a lot of those activities people actually don't do for their intrinsic value. They do because they get addicted to them, and they get more into a mindless state than a deep zone state.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost seems like this flow idea is not necessarily Zen or Buddhist at all. But it's just, I've seen people who are in states of like mania and obsession that get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's a sense of getting lost, but there's also a total, almost like zombie mode. It's not awareness, it's hanging out with a serious game or something.
I also think that's a legitimate critique of flow. And you know, I'm trying to give shorter talks because the only reason I give long talks is because I sat with my teachers, my Japanese teachers, for year after year after year, where they struggled with English and talked for an hour to an hour and a half. I'm trying to keep my talks down to 30 to 35 minutes because that's just, you know, easier for people to stay in flow or say semi in flow. So I was going to do a critical analysis of all this today, but I decided I won't. But you're right. Your point is good, and there's a lot to that. But of course, we can also say, so then where's the division? Where's the between mindlessness and mindfulness? What's mindless and what's mindful? When is what we think in our deep Zen is actually mindless? And when is someone who's actually doing an iPhone thing actually going into a state which is not manic, but which is really calm? I don't know, but that's a whole other area to explore. Yeah?
But it's not simple, but it seems simple.
Okay.
How does someone else benefit from someone playing on their iPhone?
Well, the only way I benefit from my wife playing on her iPhone is that then she goes to sleep, and in the morning she's nice to me, and I might get she might make an omelet. Whereas which I like, and if she's up reading, she probably will not make me an omelet. Nevertheless, that's another critique. That's actually talk number. You get in my talk for 2 weeks from now. I was going to talk about compassion, and I was going to talk about mindlessness and mindfulness. Good critiques. Nevertheless, good critiques. Yeah.
But I think of sort of the more manic state when you are focused on the outcome and you're obsessed about making, you know, a painting look a certain way, and it's just right, and you're eliminating all the
things,
as opposed to being in the moment where you're just enjoying the activity.
That's right. Enjoyment. And how do you measure enjoyment? What is enjoyment? What is wholehearted activity? Can you say that when someone is playing an app on their iPhone that they're wholeheartedly engaged? I guess you can. I guess you could. Can you say that they're deeply enjoying it? I guess you could, but it's certainly object dependent, and that's where the addiction comes in. But we can also be object dependent on the forms here at Zen Center. That's one of the reasons I'm into this traditional and contemporary thing, mixing people learning the traditional and people giving up the traditional, and just coming and sitting, because it can become addictive. We become addicted to a beautiful dance, an orchestrated ballet, which has been going on for 2,000 years, which we finally can perform in flow. Yeah.
Just to continue the thread, the thing, I'm going to talk about something that I have never experienced. So
okay.
I could be totally wrong. I think this experience of flow is sometimes experienced by people in combat, in war. And at least I've read accounts that suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
People who have been through horrible experiences where their life depended on reacting immediately to their surroundings successfully, preserving themselves.
Yes, yes.
They, I believe, were in a flow state.
Yes.
And they look back on that as a peak experience in their life.
Yes, yes. Good. So there it is.
Yeah.
So who first, Stacy or Chris?
Well, I wonder if the... aside from being an intrinsic thing, the flow state also has to meet with the flexible mind, so that it's not getting lost in the flow state, so we can still maintain relationships, not be frustrated if we perceive something interrupting that.
That seems important, doesn't it? I think that's important.
And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the practice of that, of both.
Oh, yes. Well, say a little more about the practice of both. Okay. Well, If we're really focused on our, there are a couple of things to talk about. One is if we're really focused on our activity, let's say that I'm really focused on making my omelet. If I'm really focused on Linda has been teaching you to make omelets in my life. It's a very complex process. I've been working on it for 40 years. No, anyway, so I have to be pay very close attention to the details of the activities. I want the eggs to. I need to learn how to shell them the right way. I need to get the pan just the right heat. I need to have just the right amount of oil. These are all very discriminating, specific boundary things that I have to take care of. And only by paying attention to the minute details of each of those boundaries, of each of those activities, which are totally discrete from each other. The oil, the heat of the oil is totally discrete from the breaking the egg, which is totally discrete. Only by paying attention to each of those discrete components, am I able to be in flow to do the egg? So that requires attention to the details of boundaries, attention to details of practical and concrete life, which enables me just to do it. So, and if somehow I get into an ecstasy while I'm doing the eggs, I'm probably going to ruin the eggs. And that ecstasy is not flow. It's some kind of ecstasy that's not what we're talking about in Zen. We're talking about the merging of time and timelessness, the merging of form and formlessness. But it manifests itself in the form, because in each form and taking care of each form in a discriminating way and not getting mixed up. Now I don't know if that's what you're asking me to talk about, Stacy. Is that what you're asking me to talk about? Did you have something more on that?
I think that's the most helpful. I was also talking just about in a matter of relationship, if you were making the omelet and you're really into that, but
flexible versus fixed mindset. If I have a fixed mindset on making this omelet and you come into the room and you're kind of upset about something, and I just ignore you, that's my fixed mindset on the omelet. my flexible mindset is not caught by, it's just open to your presence, and so it immediately adjusts to your presence, to maybe your pain or your anxiety or your desire to tell me I should do the omelet a little differently, because and then I'm aware of that. Then I take that in. So flexible mindset has to go with flow. Has to go with flow, or it's not. And then compassion, but let's not go there. Except that intimacy and compassion, really. If you're intimate, if I'm doing my egg, I'm feeling really close to the omelet. Oh yeah, again. But then you come in the room, and my mind's still. I'm really aware, so I'm aware of your presence. So I'm just as intimate with your situation, and even the fact that you're trying to teach me, as I am with the omelet. Then I've really made my big effort. Then I'm really engaged. Chris?
Well, I guess this speaks to some of the things that were already brought up, and I think this is something you'll put off for another talk, but it has to do with the compassion aspect, and that it seems that flow states and 10,000 hours don't necessarily lead to compassionate or enlightened activity. Well, it seems like there's plenty of examples of people who would use that those techniques to develop skill in all kinds of not so great activities, including the samurai who very much kind of supported Zen practice, become essentially better killers. So it seems like there is some other necessary practice that has to be brought into the development of those flow states, or will the flow state itself eventually lead to compassion?
Well, you know what Buddhist teaching is about this. Buddhist teaching is that the samadhi, which is the cultivation of the flow state, which is what? Effort, number 6, number 7, and number 8 on the path. Effort, mindfulness, and concentration leads to wisdom, leads to breaking through the confines of small Tim, and then feeling a compassionate, a loving connection to everything. But the other component of that is Shila, is morality. So we've got ethical behavior. So that's why when I do this ceremony in September, and a bunch of people have been sewing these little cuties here. They've been sewing all summer on these, and we won't get into that now. But I'm the preceptor. That's my primary job, is to be the preceptor. My primary job then for 2,000 years as a teacher is to talk people to talk with people and to help them commit themselves to behaving ethically in the world. And that's the whole thing. They take the precepts. They imbibe the precepts. They're not just in their head. I am the preceptor. And that's actually supposed to come before meditation. And if you look on the path, it becomes before meditation. You take the precepts early, and you do it every month for the rest of your life, or every day for the rest of your life. So that's the psychology behind it in Zen, and that's not true with the samurais. I mean, they didn't do that stuff. Now, does it always work in Zen? No. But what always works? What always works?
So there is that very necessary component of simultaneously cultivating ethical behavior, compassion, to supplement that those flow states. Because flow states bereft of compassion.
Yep.
Can be very dangerous.
That's right. Yep. That's another. So you guys are giving my talk for 2 weeks from now. I'll do it. I'll give something else in 2 weeks. So. Go ahead. You guys are good. Go ahead.
If a flow state is interrupted by a need, like in my case when I'm publishing, sometimes I'm interrupted by opportunity and problems that are unrelated to what I do, but are necessary in order for other people to access server-side technology. And so, when those problems became a part of my life, I started to and I'm in a flow state with my publishing, I've expanded that to include anything that might prevent me from publishing. You know, like sort of getting involved in, and that became a flow state. You know, going into you know, the, you can't stop me.
It's
a, you know, kind of a fierce determination to see through with whatever is, you know, in my way in the same effort. The same effort is, but it expands and adapts, you know. And yeah, I think there is good intention most among the other results. Selfish need. And I think need both can inspire, or, you know, there can be both motivation to move forward and something driving is preferable to being moved forward with something. And that seems to be the state. But when it's interrupted, that, what I notice is that there's a lot of adaptation in all of this, and it seems to expand into all kinds of areas.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. And, you know, I that's good. So I want to close this discussion by saying that if you really want to be a Zen practitioner, forget about flow. Completely forget about it. That's how I want to close. Okay. Thank you. I'm serious. I'm completely serious.